Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brennan, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. And you guys, 2016 Maximum Fun Drive, it's just moments away. It's coming. Join us for the best 2 weeks in podcasting and show your support for Pop Rocket and for Maximum Fun. We will have our best shows of the year across the Maximum Fun network. Meetups will be happening in 30 different cities across the United States and Canada. And we've got some amazing exclusive gifts for new and upgrading members. This all kicks off on March 14th and runs for just 2 weeks. So don't miss out on the excitement. Mark your calendar and find more information at MaximumFun.org. All right. That was me doing the responsible business of keeping Maximum Fun afloat. You're welcome, Jesse. But with me to talk TV, film, music, and everything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wobbler.
Hi, Guy.
Hey, Margaret, what's going on?
Not much. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
I like your dress. Thank you.
Margaret and Winter, we have a new friend with us.
Yes.
He is my friend, but I would like him to become your friend very soon. He is a very funny comedian. He is a writer for Tosh.0, and the former host of Maximum Fun, Sadly Missed, Wham Bam Pow podcast,
please.
Ricky Carmona.
Oh, hey, how's it going, everybody? Nice to meet everybody. I love you. What a new people. It's good. It's so good.
Welcome. That fake flattery will get you everywhere.
Yes, that's what we love.
Ricky, just a quick question. Are you allowed to podcast if there aren't two women and some gayness present?
This is I put this in my contract. I will only show up to shows with this requirement.
That's very reasonable. Ricky, coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson.
Plus,
we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, we have to find out what arts and entertainment news or event have caught our attention this week. So, Ricky Carmona.
Yes.
What are you all about this week?
I am all about that House of Cards season 4,
Okay. With you on that.
I was deeply bored by season 3. I need you to convince me that I should watch season 4.
Okay. Well, I need to start by saying this. House of Cards is not the show that I thought it was going to be.
Okay, how?
I was expecting David Fincher, Kevin Spacey, hardcore political drama. It's not that show.
Okay.
It's just a straight up soap opera in a White House. All right. That's all it is. I was out season 2. Season 2, I was like, fuck this nonsense.
But season 2 is great. The problem was once he became president, there was nothing left to do. It was always him trying to solve problems without any sort of like nobility or West Wing behind it.
I guess I was more interested in that. Isn't it like the first episode of season 2, he pushes he pushes old girl in front of a fucking train?
Yeah.
Are you running for the president of the United States, bro? You hire somebody to do that.
Exactly.
That's what where's Doug at? Doug, handle your shit.
You mean Stamper?
Yeah, exactly.
That's Stamper's job.
Exactly, Stamper.
That's
Get down there.
So what is this season giving us?
This season right now is the president and the first lady, Robin Wright, who is the best thing on the show.
Love her.
She's the best thing on the show. I think she's better than Kevin Spacey. They are going at it hardcore against each other. Like each season, they give Frank Underwood a villain, and this year the villain is her. And I think it's fucking great.
That's awesome.
And I think it's great.
That's
fantastic.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
It's interesting. During the later part of the Clinton administration, we had all of these interesting fictionalizations of Bill Clinton. We had Bullworth. We had the American president. And it was usually they were, well, what if the president were
like
actually a liberal and could date? Yes. Had Air Force One. What I find interesting now is that we are sort of getting to this point of trying to fictionalize Hillary. I mean, we've been doing it for a while with Political Animals and Madam Secretary. But I really feel like Claire Underwood is sort of us looking at the darkest and scariest parts of Hillary that excite us most and terrify us most.
Yeah, actually, I never made the connection between Claire and Hillary. But yeah, Claire is
you
almost Hillary done right.
No.
Does it make terrible for me to
maybe,
say that?
But you're looking. But what you should totally juxtapose it towards is Joel Kinnaman's role. So
yes.
Joel Kinnaman comes in as like this Obama-ish.
Should I say I haven't finished the season yet?
Oh, what are you doing here?
are you already done with season 4?
I'm done. Cleared through the whole thing.
I'm on episode 8.
Yeah, I'll do the... All right. Joel Kinnaman
Yes.
is sexy as fuck, but I like that he is sort of counter to all of that. And that makes it actually kind of reinforces their purpose because
yes.
he's being a little too, I don't know what to say, but like he's just being a little too jovial about the whole thing. And Claire and Frank are a little bit more, you know, presidential.
Absolutely. Yes.
What are you all about this week?
I went to see at the Blacklist Live. So Franklin Leonard is a really good friend of mine. And he produces The Blacklist, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but for those who
let's explain
not,
it to America because it's a very Hollywood thing.
So every year there's a tracking board that has become a thing. And the tracking board is where you put scripts on there and then people vote to what's the best script.
So basically, creative executives in the film industry are always reading scripts, and they have these boards where they have like conversations about what's really good, and that's where buzz happens. And so the site, the Blacklist, decided to actually quantify that, give all of them one vote, and then at the end of the year publish a list of what sort of like the buzziest screenplays are.
Yeah,
little things you may not have heard of, like The Imitation Game or The Social Network. Basically, like coming up number one on the Blacklist is a short road to being nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah,
and so what they've started doing is producing live readings of some of these buzzy unproduced screenplays.
Yeah,
and
they do it at the Ricardo Montalban Theater in Hollywood, and they get celebrities.
I live right up the street from there.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Who did they end up getting this time?
They got Lena Dunham was supposed to be there, but then she had her thing. Uh-huh. They had James Brolin. They had John Cho. They had Chris Parnell.
And this is a Reagan biopic.
This is a Reagan biopic, and I have to say, it was the timing and the intuition on my part to even the impetus to go was like, I wanted to go because we're obviously in the middle of this crazy election, and I wanted to see something that sort of harkened back to that old, you know, era where this was still kind of like a civilized process. And the script is called Reagan. It's written by a young writer who has not produced anything yet. But basically the sort of narrative is that we're following Reagan as he wins his second term. And as we follow him throughout the entire course of the term, as obviously we're going into dealing with the Iran-Contra trials. Is Iran, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was a little kid, so just forgive me if I don't know.
And also his Alzheimer's.
Which was always sort of like a question and not really confirmed until well until he was out of office. And basically,
Who played Reagan?
James Brolin.
Oh, okay.
Who's played it many times.
Yeah.
So essentially, we follow him as someone basically purports to, in on his cabinet, purports to be the person that pretended to be Frank Capra, helping him along. So he positioned himself as Frank Capra for 4 years.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Giving him direction and telling him his mark. Yeah. And when they basically presented Reagan as if Reagan was gone from the moment he stepped into the second term. It was fascinating to watch. It was obviously not true. We don't know how much is, but this man did a ton of research when he wrote the script, and it was very, very beautifully reading the script. I would totally see this movie. It was fascinating.
Poll the room: who loved W, who hated W?
I loved W. Loved it.
Surprised that I enjoyed it.
I adored it.
It was on this weekend. I adore that movie.
Whatever Tandy Newton was doing, do more. Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I'm about Broad City's latest
season.
Yes,
season 3.
Queen.
Yes, queen.
Because it is hard to come back for a third season. Do you know what I mean? Like, the first two seasons, you get a lot of fanfare and the critics loving you, and you're new. You're the new kid on the block. But now they've you know, been established. And so I find that this season, they're even digging in their heels more on their comedy style. And it's super physical. It's super hilarious. I think both Alana and Abby
fucking scene where she found out that Lincoln had had sex with another woman.
Penis kiss.
I mean, the physical comedy that was going on of so many different shapes and sizes.
I know.
I had no idea that Alana Glazer had that in her. It's fucking amazing.
You didn't notice it when she literally painted her stomach red?
No, yes.
To pretend like she had a shirt on?
But, no, I'm talking physical comedy. I'm talking being able to just effortlessly turn your body into a little lever, go down and kiss his dick, and then...
And then pop up and do a headstand.
Yeah. I mean...
On his dick.
It's amazing. I had some people who were saying like they didn't think it was as good, and so I went into it with somewhat lowered expectations. I feel like the degree to which they are able to inhabit the characters and sort of like a different lexicon of comedy than what we're used to, like you know, just having them reproachfully yell, "You're lying to your wife," talking about their relationship with each other. That relationship is like nothing we've seen on television.
Absolutely. And I feel like both of them as characters, I just have a much more distinct idea of who they both are. And I think they were trying to do that in the first and second seasons, but it didn't get established as much as it should have. Whereas this time now, they are going with these storylines that are really hinged on certain characteristics that they have.
The co-op episode.
Co-op episode.
Ooh.
So amazing where Abby has to be Alana. Or I would say where Abby is super competitive and Alana has to soothe her. Because A, it was great to have Abby be out there and Alana be the one who is straight manning. But to have her gently whisper BB&B at right at opening, it's just you and the employees. So that if you know that show, the way that it roots into Abby's love of Bed Bath & Beyond.
I know, and then she put her in that, like, calming headlock. It's amazing.
I love them so much.
It's beautiful. But what are the thing that is best about that show, in my opinion, is just that the mechanics of the drama are so simple. I dropped a key. It really is like old school radio comedy levels of just like, we need to go buy a postage stamp today and find
it's
all
Nichols
of the ways.
It's Nichols in May.
It is so good. It is so good.
They, really fast, the Whoopi Goldberg cameo last week gave that episode. I actually thought that was like kind of like a low episode, but as soon as Whoopi came in there, it all tied together.
I was a little confused at the beginning of the 90s dance, but it grew on me.
I knew she was coming. I could feel it. I could feel it.
Your Whoopi radar was bleeping.
Whoopi's in here. There's a Whoopi coming. I know it. There she is.
Delightful. And also a moment that is giving sort of like, it was giving a moment to one of the supporting characters, which they have a little more space to do this season. Also, the work that they do to employ really, really talented New York comics who don't necessarily have a huge amount of buzz and who are women and gay guys. Like, is really, really awesome. Seeing Bowen Yang or Katina Corral, people who...
Who's the roommate?
Oh, I don't know who the roommate.
The Hispanic roommate, the guy. Jaime.
He's not a stand-up. He's not a stand-up guy. I don't know him. But
he's delightful.
But like really, really great people who are really funny and the industry doesn't know what to do with. Like these two girls are like, we fucking know.
Yeah.
They also like work with props so brilliantly. Like, I mean, the fact that Vanessa Williams was on there with that totally absurd bun. And it's like, you could tell it just brought her to life that she had to like twist her head like a bobble and keep this bun afloat. It was amazing.
Or Alana's bicycle helmet / ridiculous wig that she had attached to it.
I mean, brilliant. Vanessa Williams singing the poop song.
Yes.
I mean, everything.
Everything. You might want to, you know, put that clip in, Christian.
Yes. 4 and 3 and 2 and 1, 1.
Sorry about that. I just wanted to show you the bathroom myself, personally.
Thanks, I'm familiar.
Also, if you need sanitary napkins or similar products, we give those away free here. I understand. My mom spotted well into her 60s.
Thanks, Don.
I shit.
Okay. This week, I have two things. First one is an article by Caroline Seed or Seedy in the AV Club, which was just breaking down being a feminist and having feminist criticisms of movies is like liking Return of the Jedi but hating the Ewoks. Was just such doing the hard work of sort of like breaking down to a clear pattern for people who don't have to confront issues like that, what it's like to run into a piece of culture that you love and enjoy but have issues with, because people always want to assume that if you are criticizing something for having gender issues or race issues or whatever, that you're just saying it's bad. And you're not necessarily saying it's just bad. You're saying,
It has a problem.
And so I thought that that was nice, clean, good work. And also at a time when we are so ready to block people and dismiss people, doing the work of explaining to people who are half-assedly trying to figure out how this shit works, mm-hmm. a clear formula so that they can go about understanding it a little bit better.
It all reminds me of that Onion headline that they had maybe a year or two ago that was like, feminist turns off brain to enjoy TV. There's that idea that you just cannot be a fully aware viewer if you're a feminist, like that that you'll just hate everything. And
right.
I think that's like an old construct, an old idea about feminism that's dogged it in a lot of ways. That, like, they're humorless, right? They like can't get over anything. And in reality, it's like, I mean, take Mad Max,
Margaret,
for example.
Hey, Margaret. Huh? How many feminists did it take you to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know.
That's not funny.
Look at your face when you said it, guys.
I'm sorry I interrupted. That's my favorite joke.
It's a good one. I forgot. I don't remember what I was saying.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I blanked. All right. Well, okay. Cheers.
And then
cheers.
The other half of my All About, the main part of my All About, is like our main topic this week is American Crime Story.
Oh, wait, I remember.
Okay, go.
Okay, can I just say Mad Max, for instance?
Yes.
Like, I loved that movie. I had a problem with the way they portrayed women at certain points.
Yes.
Or the fact that they didn't portray them enough.
Sure.
And like a film where it is trying to make active, significant feminist gestures in a genre that traditionally doesn't. And you can understand that all of that stuff is good while still saying there are still problems.
Yes.
It's not enough. It's a start, but it's still not enough.
Yes. Things in America were not fixed when we elected that first black congressman. okay. So the other half of my All About this week is really enjoying American Crime Story loving that relationship of true facts, but fictionalization and camp. I went back to one of my favorite things ever. It is a British TV movie called The Long Walk to Finchley. And it is basically a fictionalization of a young Thatcher trying to get her first parliamentary seat. But it is campy as fuck. Like, it is really saying, this woman who we all know, how the fuck did she end up axing her way through a bunch of guys who had just returned from the war to manage to get a conservative seat that was like winnable that she would get to run in? And it basically kind of suggests that she suggested a kind of like power partnership with this closeted gay guy who ended up becoming prime minister as well, and that he like turned her down and she was like, fuck you, I'll do it anyway. It is available on Amazon. You guys know that I love British politics too much, and I know that most people don't,
and
Canadian. But it is everything that the Iron Lady wasn't. The Iron Lady was just shit. It had no...
I don't understand this about you, and this is really upsetting for
me.
Why? Because I love that movie. When she's going to get the milk, the opening scene with the milk...
Oh. Look, I enjoyed watching that movie to the extent that it gave me...
That movie.
So the thing is that I know those stories of what made Margaret Thatcher Margaret Thatcher so well and so deeply that I want to see them told well.
And I can't take that away from you.
And in fullness, just like on The Blacklist, there was a screenplay about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah.
And some issues with it. Like, it really didn't capture
what... You know Natalie Portman's going to play that.
It's all falling apart. If you think I didn't pull all strings possible to go to the director of that movie and say, hey, let's get coffee so we can have a conversation. And Marielle Heller did, because she's the best. But I believe it is falling apart right now. All right, you guys. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson, after this.
I think the main reason why I love Bullseye is Jesse's ability to really ask sincere questions, not just because he's trying to get an interesting answer, but because he seems to really want to know.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to the magician Ricky Jay and to the menswear writer Bruce Boyer, plus comedy from Brandy Posey on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Ricky Carmona.
And the best show on TV right now, everyone can agree, is FX's American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson. If you're not watching this show, get the fuck with it.
Yeah, you should probably turn this off and wait until you've seen at least a few.
Also, sorry.
There will be spoilers for what happened in 1995. All right. So, Margaret, put your finger on exactly what makes this show transcendent. Why does it go beyond watchable or entertaining to something that everybody delights in?
Well, it's really smart about recognizing what about this trial still matters today.
Uh-huh.
The fact that, you know, it's a fascinating trial in and of itself when you just take 1994 and 1995 and what was happening then. But it's still fascinating now because there are still, of course, issues with race, issues with gender, these things that completely came into play during the trial in ways that were kind of shocking. You know, OJ was acquitted during the trial, and I think that was an extremely obviously divisive moment in the nation's history. You know, there was half of the people seemed to think he was innocent and half of people thought he was horribly guilty. So, I mean, I think it's still one of these things where there's so many of us that think, how did he get away with this?
Right.
And when you think back to the kind of domestic abuse that he was accused of and the fact that that barely even came into play during the trial, that's shocking. So reviewing it in terms of that, like just in terms of how it still matters is, I mean, it's unbelievably fresh in a strange way still.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the other element of it is that it manages to mix serious reflection on kind of like the key issues of our time with camp.
Yes.
With a outsized, ridiculous approach to these things that happened 20 years ago. There are strong veins of nostalgia to it. It's wonderful. Oh, yeah, Philip Vanatter. He was a guy. I remember him being talked about on the news. But more than that, it hits this element of like both inhabiting characters and living their truth, but also celebrating their outsizedness. Like the stunt casting is amazing. Like
the casting is unbelievable.
It's fantastic.
Is there a casting choice better than Schwimmer?
No.
Robert Morris as Dominic Dunn. Killing it.
I mean, fucking the one Dominic Dunn scene we got.
Right.
Where there were candles everywhere and everyone was wearing a fucking mink.
Stacking Bram.
That was great.
Yeah, it was like almost a scene from Downton Abbey.
Yes.
But they're talking about the OJ trial.
Like, Schwimmer manages to take this guy who basically hasn't been able to do anything since Friends because he was such a personality.
Yeah.
And then right at the point when we've forgotten him enough, hook him into this other person who is, as the patriarch of the Kardashian family, such an icon of pop culture.
Yes.
And somebody pointed out to me recently, I didn't even think about it, 94 is when Friends happened.
Exactly.
Like, he is also an inhabiting spirit of this time.
Exactly.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, yeah, pretty much everyone in it is some kind of, they have a tie to the 90s, a significant tie to the 90s.
Winter, do you get annoyed? There's been criticism of them underlining the Kardashians of it all too much. Do you have a problem with that?
I don't, because it's relevant. And the fact of the matter is, we wouldn't have them had their father not been involved at that point.
But also, in a broader sense, we wouldn't have them if we had not exploded this one story into a situation where we needed to see all aspects of people's lives.
If this were not O.J. Simpson, this would have been a civil case that would have happened, and it would have been like the top story in KTLA,
maybe.
For a couple weeks, maybe.
To take Chris Ross's joke, we would have been Orenthal the bus-killing murderer.
Exactly.
That's what it would have been. Yeah. We wouldn't
100%.
Give a shit.
We wouldn't have given a shit. Yeah. It just cuts across too many verticals that are still relevant today. Race, class, sex, money, all of that stuff. Being Hollywood, not being Hollywood, being on the periphery of Hollywood, wanting it really bad.
I mean, on the periphery of Hollywood is like, there's just something so juicy about...
The thirst of people on the periphery of Hollywood is something I will never, ever fully comprehend.
Letting, what's her name? Connie Britton.
The morally corrupt Faye Resnick.
Having Faye Resnick and giving Faye Resnick her moment is like, yes, exactly. Because, like, how much this TV show is obsessed with upscale eateries of the late
90s. Yes! And she can only go to Cuvée on Robertson and Robertson is dead. In 2016, you did all that bullshit and you can only go to Cuvée on Robertson and Robertson is dead.
So, it is so Hollywood and understands Hollywood so well. Okay. Ricky,
yes.
Why is this not camp? Why are we able to understand it as it is camp, but why are we also able to understand it as good?
Well, it does a thing. The show does a thing that I just love. It blows my mind away. It's able to like turn your emotions on a dime. Mm-hmm. The I think it was two episodes ago where it starts. It's that amazing scene between Cochran and OJ. And Cochran is basically telling him, this is like the run of your life.
I cried during that scene.
I mean, that is like, that monologue is fucking amazing. You really, I don't care how guilty you think OJ is, when he gets to that, this is the run of your life, you're like, motherfucker, you better at least go for it.
Yeah.
And then in this same world, it can show you Cuba as OJ in a Miami nightclub getting crunk as fuck.
I love that you say it's Miami because that's exactly what I thought when I saw it. That's fucking Miami. I know Miami clubs when I see them.
Right? And you're just like, you're not looking at it at like, oh man, look at this guy. You kind of, in a sick way, you're cheering for OJ, or you're just like, you're able to appreciate the absurdity of the situation.
One of the things that is so strange is that in something that is swinging for the fences so hard, and is playing with fucking Cuba Gooding Jr. and Travolta, who we talked about on a previous episode.
Who can't even move his face. And it actually benefits the performance.
Yes!
Travolta.
Travolta is the only rival for best casting to Schwimmer because his gigantic outsizedness is so Robert Shapiro, like understanding that Robert Shapiro really thought that this was his number three concern.
And that he's being upstaged all the time by Cochran. You know what I mean? That, too, is like a perfect use of Travolta to see him pouting all the time.
The dynamics of that are so great. And I don't understand, like, there's something so beautiful about the fact that he's able to deal with race and gender in such, like, well-composed ways that none of this gets in the way of it, and you really can have those moments. Like, I love nothing more than the fact that who's more happy for this show than Marcia Clark?
Seriously!
It's the whole time, like, exploring the ways that she was not respected and not given power and treated as an object. Like, that this was the point in time when we would give a woman a position of power but do everything possible to undercut her in it. All of that, and in that way, it is also an imagining of Hillary. But just a moment.
Okay.
But that it can also put her in a position where she doesn't get Johnny Cochran, she does not.
She has her blind spots.
Yes. Yeah. And understanding that this can be a smart, capable woman who is fighting against the system, does not get race. And the interplay between her and the guy playing Chris Darden is fucking
so
it's
good.
Beautiful.
It's really
wonderful.
Great.
Beautiful.
It's really great. The small talk between them, I love the scene where, I believe, like, she basically, like, wants to go home, and she just has this line of, like, as long as I don't have to get out of my chair. And it's like, I would think if you read that in the script, you can read it as, like, hey, just, like hurry it up. Don't make me do much. But she says it in such a way, like, these people have known each other for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even though they just argued and yelled, or she kind of, like, gave him a little of, like, you're going to do what I tell you because I'm your superior.
Exactly.
Just, like, 2 seconds later, she can be like, hey, it's cool.
Yeah.
And he does, and he's still holding it in him, but it's not, like, stopping the relationship
like
of what's going on.
They act like civil servants.
Absolutely.
They act like civil servants.
I mean, the scale.
This is the job.
The scale of what is going on between that dream team and these people who are civil servants.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's fucking wonderful. All right. Is anyone going to get more Emmys than Courtney B. Vance?
Like, no,
I mean, Sarah Paulson. Sarah Paulson's going to clean the hell up.
Clean the fuck up.
Okay.
I think both of them are, they're working on another level than what that show is having.
Yes.
First of all, may I say, I have long maintained that the Emmys for TV movie and miniseries exist to keep the careers of our respected black actors and actresses alive when they cannot get better vehicles. But also aging lesbians. It's done very well for aging lesbians.
There's something about her performance, and that's what I was going to bring up when I tried to interrupt earlier.
Yeah.
I interrupt all the time, Ricky.
That's all right. Say that shit.
Last night's episode was called Marsha, Marsha, Marsha.
Right.
Which just, God damn it, Ryan Murphy, when you just nail it, you fucking nail it. And he directed last night's episode, and the episode was tied towards sort of focusing on her narrative and the fact that she was completely, we saw earlier in the season that nobody liked her, nobody was interested in her, and the public narrative for her was the sentiment was negative.
The episode where they say, oh, black women don't trust you, and she starts going through, no, but my job is to help people, including a large number of black women.
Civil servant.
It was just like, oh, you're
and
not
she's
kidding.
Worked on domestic abuse cases with black women, so she can't understand
she
it.
Yeah.
She's like, what are you talking about?
But, because the idea of optics, the idea that she is having to perform, it took me back to, there was a British art critic in the 80s who wrote an essay where he said, men act, women appear. And it basically is this, like, that all women are at all times expected to be aware of their appearance and their seeming.
Yes, 100%.
And this is somebody who's just trying to be a lawyer the way that lawyers are lawyers, and it doesn't work.
When she goes to the salon, it's the first time I went to Sally Hershberger 7 months ago, and it was so bizarre to me to go to Sally Hershberger and get my hair lightened, even though I've been in Los Angeles for 15
years.
We're going to have to talk about that whole experience. It's like I felt like I had to do it because at the time I had this big, big time job. And then I realized, even after I walked out of there, I look fucking ridiculous. This is not me. This is not who I am. I'm Winter Mitchell. I don't have to do shit like this.
Right.
And I identified with last night's episode so much because she was trying to be what she thought that they were trying to turn her into. And the moment that they microaggressed into her, Ito, she walks into the courtroom and he's like, I think, fuck you, Judge Ito, you bitch ass. And then she turns over and she sees Robert Shapiro give her that fucked up thumbs up.
Yeah.
And then starts crying because all she wants to do is come do this stupid fucking case where she knows he's guilty and then go home to her children.
She was trying trying to remove it from the narrative, and it just made it more of a narrative.
It made it more of a narrative.
Okay. Which actor is having the most fun? Ricky Carmona.
I think Courtney B. Vance might. I don't know if he's having the most fun.
But he certainly has a role that is cut out for showboating. It's all about grandstanding.
Early on when he's like in the bedroom with his wife and he's like got like the silk robe on and they're talking and he's just like going through like what he's going to say. I was like, motherfucker, you are running shit right now, dude.
Ricky, because you can and I can't. Explain the scene last week where he and Chris Darden had a pretrial hearing about the use of certain language.
Ricky, please lay that shit and lay it like the... This is Pop Rocket, so you can go as far and as deep as you would like.
Christian, if you edit this out, I will cut you.
We will all cut you.
I feel like you have more. You have more to say on
my
this
brother.
Than I know.
You got to. Well,
I'm Cuban, so I feel like I can go so far.
No, my hermano.
Okay.
Mi hermano.
I mean, you fucking feel so bad for Darden because it's like,
because you know what you was trying to do.
Yeah, exactly.
I respect what you're doing, bro.
But that's not the game you're playing. You're playing checkers, and he's playing chess. Exactly. What the fuck is wrong
doing
with you?
Okay, it's a pretrial motion about whether the N-word will be allowed to be used.
Jesus.
Darden makes a hard argument against it.
Fucking Cochran, brilliant. Do you think that we're so dumb and crazy that we don't know how to make a right decision based on a word that we hear?
Yeah.
The fuck is wrong with you?
Your Honor,
that's what this case is about.
We should say, though, that he basically tried to rule that word out to protect Mark Furman in this backwards way.
Yeah.
You know? Because he knew that was sort of the smoking gun that could potentially come out about
Margaret
Mark
with the wind. Wobbler with the wind.
But after argument, what does he say to Chris Darden?
I'm not saying it. You go ahead and say it.
I mean, come on. If anybody
he said N-word, please.
It is an amazing moment of television.
It almost feels like they turned all the audio down and just the way he delivers it.
Because I literally was like,
camera angle. Ooh.
I know that the script is very loyal to the reality, but did that one happen?
I read Vanity Fair, and Vanity Fair has, I got to give it up to Vanity Fair. They've had an amazing fact check literally an hour after the episode.
Oh, that's
East Coast,
amazing.
Amazing. It didn't quite happen that way, but it kind of in and around happened that way.
Margaret, okay. Who's having the most fun?
Oh, God. I mean, I still just got to stand behind Sarah Paulson as just like completely running the show in terms of her performance. I feel like all the sort of arrows, like if everyone is an arrow, they're all pointing towards her. Do you know what I mean? Like her energy is incredible.
There's so much depth to what she does, but there's also that moment where she pulls out some whiskey and says, "You want a drink?"
Yeah.
And Darden says, "I only drink tequila," and then she pulls out tequila.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Where they have these moments together where it's just like,
I just feel like as an actor, it's a feast, you know? Like, you get to do everything. You get to be commanding. You get to be vulnerable. You get to be scared. You get to be strong. Like, all of it's there.
I mean,
sexual, too. Like, she has this flirtation with Christopher Garden.
They totally
aren't you the one who tweeted that Sarah Paulson did more acting in the cold open of last night's episode than most people do all season?
Yes, Guy. Yes, I did. And I did it because I don't like tweeting at celebrities because I think it's the thirstiest shit ever. But I
but
did
you're
it.
Giving her a compliment.
I was
she
giving her a compliment because I was I laughed and cried in that cold open.
Yeah.
And she responded with,
oh, did she?
Yes, she responded. You didn't see it. She responded with two monkey faces covering their eyes and a kissy face. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, oh my God, Sarah Paulson.
Winter, who do you think is having the most fun?
Sarah Paulson. Sarah Paulson. I'm not saying more than what
David
they've
Schwimmer,
said.
I think, is a second runner up.
Close
just,
second.
Just when he says juice.
Juice.
He is
juice.
Having so much fun.
Juice of it all is good. But the answer is Connie Britton as Faye Resnick. Because all she has to do, like, just swan in and smoke cigarettes and be ridiculous.
And I've never seen a woman eat a carrot stick like that. I mean, she manages to like blow smoke and eat a carrot
that's
stick.
That's an
all
LA
in one motion.
Bite. I want to call that. That's an LABite.com. That's an LA bite. Okay.
It was wonderful. Okay. So let's dig in a little bit more with the way that this is really
Los
sort of
Los Angeles courtrooms.
Oh, okay. The Great Leveler. The reason it is wonderful to have celebrities on trial is because they can't pay their way into a better class of experience. It is the same one.
Yeah.
And it's why celebrity
Although
trials...
Although questionable in a way. I mean, don't you think celebrity always factors into it?
I mean, you can get better lawyers, but you also have to... Basically, what I'm saying is... Those shitty fluorescent lights of a Los Angeles courtroom.
Right. They'll still show your wrinkles no matter who you are.
That bad yellow paint. The thing is that celebrity trials aren't as good on the East Coast because you have rich woods and beautiful experience where there is just something so cheap and humiliating about a Los Angeles courtroom.
I was at dinner at Madea the other night and I ran into Marty Singer and I was like, and I'm friends with his daughter, and I was like, I need your help on something. And I told him what it was for and he was like, I don't do that. And shook my hand and gave me a kiss and walked away. Like, he's in for the big time. He wants big time, big dollars, and that's what Los Angeles courthouses are about. They're like big time, big dollars.
Well, I mean, that breakfast meeting between F. Lee Bailey and Robert Shapiro, and we all could just smell exactly which Beverly Hills lunch place that was.
Nathan Lane is also killing it on the show.
Oh,
yes.
Nathan Lane is...
And Rob Morrow, poor Rob Morrow.
I don't think anybody's doing a bad job on the show.
Nathan Lane is like like him lowering his voice to heterosexuality is almost plausible, and then you realize it when it's deployed for a really. That, like,
He's holding it in.
It just tears you apart. Yeah. And like I love the way F. Lee Bailey is presented as like the weird counterbalance that allows
he was
Johnny
the most
Cochran,
reasonable of the entire
well,
dream team.
I mean, because he cared the least,
right?
And so was
and
able,
had the least to lose,
and so was able to just sort of say, Shapiro can't win this. Cochran has to do this. Like, there's a moment when they are in a meeting, and like nobody's doing the work of telling Robert Shapiro he's no longer like the attorney.
A scene that was far too long.
And also, if you have not dealt with celebrities... No, it was exactly long enough. Because if you've dealt with celebrities whose appeal is based on being liked,
right.
You've been in that situation.
I have.
We've both...
Yes.
In Los Angeles...
Somebody has to step the fuck up.
And like, F. Lee Bailey is the person who understands, well, this is my... You're like, I don't give a shit. I don't care if Bob Shapiro's mad at me.
Yeah.
I'll just fucking do it. It's so fucking good. Okay. So, like, let's talk about this interplay of race and gender, because I think that it is very brave of this to not just be something that is attempting to talk about the relationship between law enforcement and Black America, but is also layering in both the domestic violence and the way that Marsha Clark was treated fundamentally differently. Yes. Margaret, you were bringing up the point that Black women are such an important character without being a character in this story.
Yeah, well, I my one complaint about the show is that there is not a juror who's featured, for instance. Like, the fact that the jury was mostly Black females and that they acquitted O.J., and they acquitted O.J. in part because they had true sympathy for him as a Black man that they felt like was getting framed by the police. And also that they didn't like Marsha Clark, they didn't like Nicole Simpson. And so I think that's a really interesting story still to tell about America, that that's still a perception that's out there that, like, feminism is a white woman's issue. And it's not about Black women at all. So why should they worry about what happened to Nicole Simpson? Why shouldn't they lift up this man who has been a pillar of the community in their eyes? So, you know, that to me is something really important about the show, that I wish there was more of a voice to, like, for a Black woman in the show, like, who thinks that way. I want to hear from her directly. It's always, like, sort of secondhand in the show.
The voice that we've got are Johnny Cochran's weird hench people, one of whom
Sean
is a
Hawley,
woman. Sean Hawley.
Who is Lindsay Lohan's... Sean...
Yeah, tell.
Speaking from... Well, Sean... I know Sean. And okay. I work with Sean when I was working with Lindsay. So, like, Sean is formidable and strong.
She's doing great work. But,
right.
But it is basically a cobbled-together role, so that both of those roles are, they are so Johnny Cochran has someone else Black in the room to be
right.
able to...
Right. But that was sort of like the establishment of his entire thing, and it was cut short because, obviously, he died. But there was... sort of this notion that he was, and they established this in,
Are you talking about, like, the secondary lawyer?
There's what's his name?
The younger Black guy and the younger
Stephen A. Smith looking motherfucker, and, okay. and then Sean Hawley, who that's Sean Hawley's role. So, you know,
is it based on a real lawyer?
That's Sean.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
Sean.
They were both in there.
Yeah, they're in there.
I remember them.
Yeah, I remember
they
them.
They look exactly like
exactly
them
like them. That's definitely Sean. And that's how Sean is.
So Sean Hawley is not an actress. She was Lindsay Lohan's attorney.
No, Sean Hawley, when you see those pictures of Lindsay when she's crying or when she gave the judge the finger and there's the beautiful Black woman next to her, that's Sean. She's Kanye's lawyer. Very
Wait,
tough.
That's she's in.
She's in the. Oh, she worked for Johnny.
That's really her in
that's,
the.
That's not her, but,
oh,
that's she's representing.
Gotcha. Okay,
that's
okay,
representing
okay, okay,
Sean.
Gotcha.
So she's a very good lawyer, attorney. But, I mean, I don't think it's about that. I think that we knew who we knew when we knew what we knew. So, like, it's like last night when they did Rosa Lopez. Rosa Lopez is
that was a train wreck, yeah.
Fucking hoot.
That actress had a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. She was having the most fun.
Okay. Children out there listening, just so you understand, when you were watching television in the 90s, they broke into programming to let you know that Robert Shapiro had been replaced as lead attorney by Johnny Cochran.
Yep.
These things were all
so crazy.
Were all news stories, but you make the point that, like, this story created its own cast of characters.
Yes.
They don't get to decide who is there. And I think there is something, the weird role of silencing Black women in the whole story of, like, you know,
We were like in the Green Lantern when you have those, like, people that were up in space that he had to go report to.
Uh-huh.
We were like that. Like,
no,
we knew where our places were. Well, we were going to determine all
exactly.
this shit.
In the not being a character,
right.
Black women end up becoming the
ominous
force that
looming.
Decides
but
the thing.
But that's the thing. It hinges on what Black women think, in a sense. That trial did. So that's what I want to hear. That's what I want to hear. Like, I kind of already know Marsha Clark's story, in a sense. I know why that's wrong.
You're not going to hear more of her from after last night's episode was completely.
Yeah, I feel like in the world of, like, the way the show is presented, the jury is just kind of this silent character who we're not going to hear from.
Yeah,
that's part of what the show is like
the
trying
verdict.
To like.
We know the verdict.
Yeah,
but also
the show's about this larger than life lawyers
the
and
way
OJ.
It happened, right? We we still don't know who the hell those people were.
Yeah, like yesterday there was some interview with one of the jurors, and I didn't even like watch the clip. I was just like,
yeah,
that's right. You're the guy who did it.
You're
Because back then they weren't really part of the story.
Right.
And the story that they got is so different from the story we got.
Right.
To tell that is to tell a different story, because this is the story of, like, the publicity of it all.
Yeah.
Like, those constant, I mean, the scene at Chin Chin's with the Kardashian
girl. Oh, my
girl.
God.
I mean, really emphasizing.
I hope that you guys know every single restaurant where they were.
It was in Brentwood. It was the Chin Chin in Brentwood, which
we
nobody
should just
goes
put together
to.
A map for our listeners of, like, the OJ trial of restaurants, or tour of restaurants, rather.
I mean, it's what a knowing Los Angeles person should know.
Like, exactly.
We should all know where to get lunch in Encino. Ricky,
yes.
The relationship between race and law enforcement in this show, so much of what Ryan Murphy does is a shit show.
Yes.
Do you feel like here he has been able to compose a coherent construction or political argument?
I think so. Yeah, because he does a smart thing where you have Johnny Cochran. Corn Beef Vance is given these monologues where he just lays it out on the line. If it was happening in this sense of, if it was shown in the same kind of, like, crazy hyper reality that other moments in the show are, then it's a shit show.
Yeah.
But when it gets to those moments, you get very serious conversations or exchanges between about what it's about. You have a serious conversation between Christopher Darden and Marsha Clark about whether or not this should be done. You have a tense moment between Chris Darden and him questioning Mark Furman about whether it should be done. It's not like he asks him a question and then a crazy 60s doo-wop song happens. Yeah. And you go, that's right, racism was crazy and fucked up. When they talk about racism, it's kind of like when the show slows down a little bit and goes, all right,
yes.
We're going to catch you up on what was really going down.
Right.
That's a really great point, that in making a narrative about civil rights that does not have a sense of its own nobility, this is busting open. Like, one of the things I bitch about most on this show is that we know how to make a civil rights movie, and so civil rights movies don't mean anything anymore because everybody's being noble and then there is poop in a pie. but this movie, like, this show, interestingly, by not taking itself seriously, allows you to just sort of, like, illustrate problems. I feel like this show does a really good job of saying, in a world where the law is being enforced by Mark Furman, everyone is less safe because it makes everyone fundamentally challenge the legal system, which means not just OJ is less safe, but Nicole Brown Simpson is less safe because it makes everyone question the authority of the, like, of the law being applied dispassionately.
Can I
fucking use of the word Simi Valley last night? Really good.
That scared so much the shit out of me the moment when that happened. I was like, fuck. You're fucked, Tom.
Can I say the question about race that I'm really enjoying well, I was aware of it, but just getting a lot of knowledge of it is the question. The scene between Christopher Darden and his neighbors over
yes,
the fence, where they're like, "We're down with OJ," and
yeah.
he's like, "I don't know if it is." And the interaction that he has with him and his dad, where his dad is trying to tell him, "Hey, man, here's what you should be doing, or stop worrying about
but
shit."
How
that's
real
a
was
world.
That?
It's very. It's
how
very real.
How real was that?
It's very real to me. It's just. It's something that I was. I've just been it just gave me an extra step in, like, okay, this was a conversation that was happening there, as
no,
opposed to
for me there's always that there's a triple conversation when you're an African American person and you've gotten a good job and you're working in a place where you're negotiating with a different masters, quote unquote.
Okay. Sure. So break that down for us.
So
what are these awarenesses?
The awarenesses is that you're having the conversation about being yourself and doing your job without a chip on your shoulder,
uh-huh.
then doing your job without a chip on your shoulder, but you're still black and they're going to treat you like you're black.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to negotiate that. You have to negotiate whether you're going to approach everything as a person doing a job and you have a skill set and you're very good at it and you can actually excel in it. And then you also have to negotiate being, I'm black.
Yeah.
And this is a black dude.
Then you have to go
and,
back.
And then
you
have to
go
back, to,
go back
to where you live.
And you have to be like, hey.
And then you got
to
deal with these ignorant-ass motherfuckers who have another position.
So there's
that you don't identify with at all because I wasn't brought up in the ghetto.
So there's barbecue conversation. There is
corporate conversation.
There is Black in America conversation.
Yes.
And then there's talented 10th conversation.
Talented 10th conversation. And you're negotiating and juggling shit. And you're like, well, I wasn't brought up in the ghetto, so I don't fucking totally get it. But then just to break it down, I identified with that conversation.
Yeah.
Besides Marsha's conversation that she was having that entire episode of Marsha, which aired last night.
So good.
I'm going to watch that one tonight.
It's fucking fantastic.
It's on fire.
I identified with that.
I never thought at the time, because I was relatively young and just didn't think about these things that much, how interesting it was that, like, whoever was assigning cases was, like, quote unquote smart
Garcetti?
Enough. Well,
poor Garcetti.
But poor
Bruce Greenwood is killing
Ito.
It in there.
He's great.
Like just that Ito, like that somebody said, hey, Asian guy, you go be referee between white and Black America.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
You figure this out with all of his fucking hourglasses that I saw those and I was like, that can't be fucking real. And it was fucking real.
I find it very interesting to think about what would happen with this trial if it was on now.
Yes.
Like, if it's happening now.
Great point, Wobbler.
And I think that, like, in particular with Marsha Clark just being attacked all the time,
yeah.
there would just be this whole sort of feminist blogger system,
sure.
the Jezebels, the whatever, that would just be, like, fighting on her behalf. And then, like, you know, whatever race issues going on with OJ, there would be, like, a whole contingent, like, Black Twitter, like, you know, any kind of element of that you want to think about would be fighting for him. Like, there'd be so much more of this public voice actually about it. Because back then, it was just people talking without any blogging, without any of that.
We just waited to listen. We were just given the information, and then we would just discuss with ourselves.
We had court TV correspondence,
exactly.
and we had private conversation,
yeah.
Exactly.
And there was nothing in between.
Yeah.
But Margaret, talk to us a little bit about just sort of like the Jeffrey Toobin of it all, that basically America's best legal correspondent, the guy who writes books about the Supreme Court, also covered this splashy celebrity trial. And the way that he's a consultant on the show, and that we do have this person who really thinks a lot about America's legal system.
Yeah.
Helping guide this story.
Yeah.
Well, you see in, what was it, the second or third episode, you see him coming and chasing down Bob Shapiro and basically being like, let me interview. Let me find out about this case. I know a little bit about it. And, you know, you see him as like kind of a young man chasing this big story. And that obviously made his career in part, like that he just was covering this. I mean, Dominic Dunn was already out there, already kind of specializing in these kinds of lurid, you know, celebrity, tabloidy trials.
Well, he had personal experience with it.
And he did have personal experience with it, you know, sadly. But I think
Dominic Dunn's daughter was murdered.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, with Jeffrey Toobin, it was more like him like grabbing the brass ring of this whole thing and following it, just like diving into every single detail of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really, you know, I've read a little bit of the book. I definitely want to read more. And it's phenomenal for what I've read so far. And I think that what's great about the script that Larry and Scott Alexander have written, Larry Karaszewski, is that it is so faithful to the book, from what I understand, and from what, you know, the Vanity Fair fact checks are revealing, that they really have done their research to such an extreme point.
I just want more Selma Blair. As
Chris Jenner. Really want more of that.
I forgot she was in it.
I forgot. I really want more of it.
Let me tell a horrible story.
Okay, go. No, you know we live for this. Go for it.
A friend of mine who is friends with Chris Jenner was at the Christmas party and was like,
recently?
Yeah, and was like chit-chatting with them about the show and about how great it was going to be. And she said, like, you guys should have viewing parties. It would be so much fun. Failing to forget that it is the story of how their friend got
Jesus.
Killed.
Why am I not surprised?
I mean, I do. I have to say, like, I think it's important for us all to remember, because I have this experience watching it, that this is real. This happened. Do you know what I mean? Like,
these
two people were murdered.
But
also,
to me.
The scene like, where the dad were wrangled and dead. It's crying and breaks that down. That's when I was like, oh, yeah.
I forgot
this
about
shit
that.
Is like really real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
2 points. I would say, first of all, if the OJ trial is about anything, kind of like Game of Thrones, it is about the periphery dominating. It is about the weird way that Faye Resnick and Ron Goldman, it's not Nicole Brown's family who matters, it's
nope.
Ron Goldman's family that matters. And the weird way that Rosa Lopez, that these small characters end up inflating to occupy space. And like for Marcia Clark and for Johnny Cochran, it was a struggle to occupy what you needed to do, but everybody else was sort of like growing and becoming gigantic off of like the CNN of it all. But also just going back and looking, like that speech by the guy playing Ron Goldman was so good, and going back and looking at this guy and
Ron Goldman's dad, you mean?
Yeah. What did I say?
Ron Goldman.
But like poor fucking Ron Goldman, who just like was a hot, bland Hollywood guy of the sort that so many are, but also like did have like qualities and characteristics that made him like a redeeming human being. But we just saw him as somebody like that guy has frosted tips, and he was and he was riding around in her car, and he is kind of tan. Fuck him.
Yeah,
is so weird because we did not have the intervening 20 years
right.
of bartenders on Survivor teaching us how to know and love that guy.
Can I ask a really quick question? I know Christian is trying to wrap us, and you're not Colin, so don't even try it.
He has rich authority and
he
power,
just, like,
and we respect him.
He just, hand in the air like, fuck you, bitch.
We respect you.
Really fast, do we think OJ did it?
I was going to ask that. I was going to ask, if you were a juror, what would you have decided? Because almost like, I understand why as a juror, they could not commit him as guilty and good conscience.
Exactly.
I mean, it is entirely, I mean.
In 94 versus 2016.
Well, the thing is I don't know what.
I think he did it. I think he did it.
I don't know what DNA evidence they held back from them. If you only had the circumstantial evidence, it would be hard. But if you had one tiny bit of that DNA evidence, well, also, there's just a lot of fucking blood around.
I was going to say, there's so much blood in this Bronco, for God's sake.
There's a lot of blood where there should not have been blood at all.
Yes. Ricky, do you think he did it?
No, I'm kidding. I think he did it.
You know that
AJ Cowlings also had an identical white Bronco.
That's insane.
Hilarious.
It's so good.
I will say, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I was just going to say, I was reading that the Goldmans, you know, when they put on the civil suit against O.J. Simpson, one thing that they got awarded was all the profits of If He Did It, which was OJ's crazy ass book about let me just hypothesize if I did this, how would I have done it?
That's the
and
most
apparently they have
thing.
Shrunken the word if and they just made it He Did It.
Oh, great.
Like they have an intro that says that.
Ricky, what were you going to say?
If he either did it or like it was him and somebody else and we're never gonna see this person again.
It's like Scream. There were two guys doing it.
Because sometimes evidence will come up where I'll be like, oh shit, I didn't know that.
You are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this. Hello, Brent.
Travis.
Welcome to Trends Like These.
What's Trends Like These, you ask? Well, it's a podcast where we take the news trending on the internet and we cover it in podcast form.
We go beyond the headlines, beyond the memes to bring you the real story so that when your friends bring it up, you can look real smart.
We take things that need to be debunked and we debunk them. And then we take things that need to be rebunked and we rebunk them.
We bring you all the details and we give you a spin on it. Our opinions, our thoughts, and we also try to dig up some positive things to talk about. So it's not all bummers.
Just a couple of real life friends talking internet trends.
So join us every Thursday on MaximumFun.org and wherever podcasts are found. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your beloved host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Ricardo Carmona.
Now, Ricky, every week on the show, we ask our panel, what's your current jam?
Yeah, you do.
Ricky Carmona, what's your current jam?
Ooh, I got this song by Anderson .Paak off the album Malibu. It's called Am I Wrong? And it is such a goddamn cut. I would put it in line with like Michael Jackson meets Jamiroquai.
Damn.
Yeah, dude, shit is hot. I love I mean, it's just like this great, Ricky, like, there's dance only funk like
a,
groove.
There's only like a 4-year window where a person can say Jamiroquai that enthusiastically.
Margaret
and I are both
blanched. I blanched a little bit. It's okay.
I am keeping Jamiroquai in business.
Good, like, okay, Ricky.
The, when they put an album out, I'm like,
you
I'll download
Rick.
That shit. I'll download
all
that
right,
shit.
Let's hear it. Is yours, is mine. And look at the time. Ooh, my God. So precious. Ooh, is yours,
is mine. Only one at a time. Guy loves this, and that's why you're in. Look at him loving the shit out of this.
I feel like Oliver could have easily played this jam.
Exactly.
Like, you're filling in well for Oliver here.
Man, this shit is hot.
Ricky, that was both a compliment from Margaret and something we in the gay community call being red. the mixture of compliment and criticism is a rich part of gay culture, and... Margaret, as a diva, as is Winter, are creators of gay culture.
Thank you very much.
That is an honor and a pleasure.
Margaret, what's your current jam?
My jam is Golden Coast by Allison Weiss. So I was driving a few months ago, and this song came on the radio, and it was a sunny day, and the sun was just like hitting my windshield perfectly, and this just captured the sunny, beautiful feeling of California. Let's hear a little bit of it.
I love when the sun hits your windshield.
This is the kind of song, too, that, like, I would hear while shopping in Forever 21 and be like, I shouldn't like this. I shouldn't yes. like it. But I do. I do. I do. So she's a local singer-songwriter. She is also living in my neighborhood. I'm not going to say what neighborhood that is. But Allison, if you see me, let's hang out and have coffee.
Margaret, when you hear something like this, do you ever feel sad for things that are... like summer jam potential, but not summer jam eligible because of their release time. Like Cake by the Ocean by DNCE, I was really like, damn, boys, why didn't you release this in like May? And this song, I'm also like, if this were on my summer jam list, I would like really like that.
I know. You know, the one thing that saves this song, though, I think it could still be part of our summer jam consideration is that it never had like a big wellspring.
Ooh, summer's yes. coming up.
Yeah.
That is a good point. Winner, what's your current jam?
Oh, Future. Sierra's baby daddy. He was on SNL this weekend with Jonah Hill, who was terrible. And he performed this song called March Madness. And it's March, y'all. So he, I don't really listen to him because I really hate negligent baby daddies. But this sounded incredible live. And I never even listened to live performances on SNL. I usually fast forward through them and get to Weekend Update. But this was great. His brand of whatever the hell he's doing, I'm with it. I don't know. It just sounded good on this stage. It sounded good at the time. And I don't know, maybe I was coming back from the club drunk, but it just sounded fucking on point. I don't know what he's doing, but this sounded on point. And as long as he's paying his bills and his child support, I'm with it.
As one of my favorite things about getting to do this podcast.
Wait, Guy. Yes, yes. How many Indie Rockers does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
You don't know.
Nice. I like that. Nice.
We should just have a light bulb joke every week.
As I was just saying, one of my favorite things is when people from this show, whether panelists or people at home, bring culture to me. not like Summer Jam. You guys like provided some really amazing stuff. And this year at the Pop Tarts, like Karen Tongson was making a hard, hard press for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Oliver had previously spoken highly of it. I think you had spoken highly of it.
Yeah.
And it took me that long to get into it.
Yeah.
And recently...
It's so good.
It's so good. It's so good. And this week, somebody sent me a video and was like, well, here's what your jam this week is going to be. And I went into it with like... all the hubris and skepticism that it takes for a really good story, because it's like, oh, what's this? And then I listen to it, and it is the best song. Let's hear it. It's from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Sweetheart, here's what you're not understanding. I'm street smart.
You mean because you minored in urban planning?
Bitch, I know you. That tough act's a bluff. So shake it, bavaka, shut the fuck up.
Your temper, you lost it. Oh, cute. Like you're gonna lose this lawsuit. But here's one category where you have no rival.
Going
frat guys with your AE pie hole.
All right.
And your hedge fund manager.
That's what I wanted.
Like, Tribe Called Quest is like, damn, we should have used that.
Yeah, why did we do this?
All right. So this is rap battle between two Jewess lawyers that is so funny. I mean, I picked that clip particularly because it had my two favorite lines in it. Bavaka, shut the fuck up. Is Hebrew for you're welcome, reflecting like the character. The character Rebecca Bunch is from Scarsdale, but Rachel Bloom is from L.A. And like, being forced to learn Hebrew as a child, Israeli Hebrew, is the most California Jew thing ever. But A.E. Pie Hole, like my friend, my best Jewess, Rebecca Cohen, I sent it to her, and shit like this she will never pay attention to, despite the fact that she was, like, her stepmom is Filipino. Like, she's a Southern California Jewess with an extended Filipino family. This show is for her, but
yeah, I was gonna say,
but like, she won't watch it because it feels too on the nose. And when she watched it, her one response was, A.E. Pie Hole is really for those of you who do not know, AE Pie is a Jewish fraternity, and an AE Pie Hole is a thing that you blow them with. So Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Learn something new every week.
Oh, and the other thing is that my friend Erin Ehrlich, who wrote with me on, or was one of the executive producers of Awkward, she is one of the writers of the show. Like, I think that or this week's episode was the first episode that she directed herself. So, among other things. Oh, and also, her former partner in crime, Lauren Ungerich, and her husband sometimes listen to this show. So, shout out to you guys. But, you know, it's lovely seeing people you really know and respect get to go and do really awesome work. So, you have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and our friend and guest, Ricky Carmona. Ricky, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having
Ricky,
me.
Thank
this
you
is so
for
dope.
Being here.
You guys are
Come
so
back.
Goddamn dope.
Oh,
I would love
can
to.
I say I something to. Really fast? I was on Mental Pod.
Oh.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yes. And it's a really intense episode, and I've gotten so much love from people about it, and I don't even know what I was saying during it.
Say the full name of Mental Pod.
So it's Paul Gilmartin's Mental Illness Happy Hour. And I did it. And it's empowering. And I hope you guys listened to it. And if you didn't, please do. And
I'm really
climb.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah,
that.
I cannot wait to
yeah.
listen.
So thank you for everybody who has and who's sent me messages. It's been tremendous and amazing. It's made me feel really good.
Awesome. And much love to Paul Gilmartin from all of us.
He's the best!
Yes.
You can find links to everybody's jams in the episode description of this podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to KMAC 2486, Dr. Sutton, The Steina, Daddy Ice Cream Cone, Smith27, and Huiona for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. You guys, we guilted you last week about how we needed more reviews, and you guys came through. And as you know, Margaret's bone density only improves.
It's true. I feel so strong, like I've been eating calcium just raw.
If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join our conversation on the Facebook group or tweet at us. We're at Pop Rocket. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the much-respected Christian Duenas and the puckish Colin Anderson. And don't forget to join us next week for, you guys, 2016 Max Fun Drive. We realize it's slightly annoying that we demand money of you, but also, you guys keep us going, and we appreciate that so much.
Yes, we do.
You keep us going, not just with the money, but also with, like, questions and comments and all of your love.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.